So I want to say hi to everybody at all of our sites and hi to everybody joining us online. We're starting a series this weekend called It's Okay Not to Be Okay. And I had to shift the beginning of the series a little. It's kind of personal, but it has to do with what we're going to talk about. So I want to say a word about this. The first week originally was going to be on God and anxiety. And I was going to do the message with our daughter, Laura. Laura's our firstborn. She has always been the most responsible person in our family. She grew up a firstborn hyperplanner with four spontaneous, disorganized, detail-avoidant, don't-pin-me-down parents and siblings, which meant she was probably doomed for lots of therapy at a very early age. She's also struggled with anxiety her whole life. She's written a lot about this, and we were going to do this message together this weekend. Earlier this summer, she told us that she was pregnant with what would have been our first grandchild. I found out when I opened a box of what was supposed to be yellow cake with chocolate frosting, and there was this little pair of cloth moccasin booties inside. I wasn't too excited. I think I stopped shouting after a couple of days. And then a few months later came the call. She was coming home from the doctor where she found out that that little heart had stopped beating and there wasn't going to be a baby. And it was so sad. It was so not okay. She and Zach are walking through this with each other and with God, and she's healthy, and there's lots to be grateful for, but it's sad. And she's heard from so many other folks who have been through this same hard journey, or a hard journey of some other kind, who bring to her the kind of comfort that only comes from the fellowship of suffering. And she's still going to come to join us and talk about what it means to live a life of faith, even when you struggle with anxiety, which we all do. But not this week. This week, I was thinking about how deeply our world is not okay and how that's a part of every human life and how often we feel like we have to pretend like it's okay even when we come to church, sometimes especially when we come to church. But really one of the most important questions for people of faith is, how do I hang on to God when it's not okay? How do I love other people when it's not okay? What do I do when I'm filled with disappointment or confusion or anger or fear? How do I keep going when it's not okay? So today, to start this series, we live in one of the oldest, strangest, most powerful stories, not just in the Bible, but in all of human history. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job, the story starts. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had seven sons, three daughters. He owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, and a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. In the land of Uz, there lived a man named Job. Now, nobody knows where Uz was. We know that it was in the east. We know that when Adam and Eve had to leave the Garden of Eden, they had to settle in the east. East of Eden in the Bible became a picture of where life is broken. In the beginning of this story, everything is as we think it should be. Everything is okay. Job is a pious man. He's cautious, so cautious, he even offers sacrifices for his children just in case, he thinks. Maybe they sinned. Maybe God is easily offended. God gives Job a wonderful life. This is real important. The amount of blessing Job experiences is directly proportional to the amount of obedience that Job offers. We'll return to that idea. But trouble is coming to Uz. Uz is the place where very bad things happen to a very good man. Uz is the place, not just where suffering comes, but where it comes without warning and without explanation, and God is not there. Uz is the land of not okay. And everybody I'm talking to right now will spend some time in the land of Uz. And maybe you're there right now. There are so many people for whom life is not okay. divorce, anxiety, depression, disappointment, problems with children, loss of job, financial weight, crushing guilt. And so often it's just beneath the surface, and we cry out, is there some place I can go where I can admit it's not okay? That's the land of Uz. Now, in verse 6 in this story, there's a radical shift in scenery. The writer sets up the book of Job like it's a play. That's part of why I am sitting where I am right now, in a theater. And there's action going on in two locations. So I want you to picture a theater with two stages, a lower stage and an upper stage. So the lower stage would represent what's happening down here on earth. The upper stage would represent what's happening up in heaven. This is crucial to the story of Job. We know, the readers, what's going on in both settings. But the characters on earth do not. All they can see is what's happening on earth. Job cannot see, he cannot hear what's happening on the upper stage. So we go to the upper stage now. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth, going back and forth in it." The Lord said to Satan, "If you consider my servant Job, there's no one on earth like him, blameless and upright, fears God, shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household, everything he has, blessed the work of his hands so his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land? But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and surely he will curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well, everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." So Satan goes out, Job loses his livestock, his wealth, his servants, his children, everything. And we wait to see how he responds. This is what the text says. At this, Job got up, tore his robe, and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I will depart. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. We're told Job grieves, he worships, he speaks words of blessing and praise. In all this, he did not sin. And that happens to Job down here on the lower story. Then the story switches back to the upper stage again. Then the Lord said to Satan, "If you consider my servant Job, no one on earth like him, blameless, upright, made of fear, shuns evil. He still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." "Skin for skin," Satan replied. "A man will give all he has for his own life. But now stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life." Now from here on out, the action in the play will be down on the lower stage. So we need to talk for a moment about what's going on in the upper stage in heaven. And the action in heaven looks really strange to us. A lot of people think that the key question in the book of Job is, where is God in the midst of suffering? But that's not the key question. The key question on the upper stage, really the key question of the whole book, is in Job chapter 1, verse 9, does Job fear God for nothing? In other words, the idea being proposed there is, God, Job is devoted to you and worships you because it's in his self-interest. It's just quid pro quo. Job loves you the way the cookie monster loves the cookie jar. If you turn off the faucet of blessing, watch how fast Job will turn off the faucet of his devotion. And here's what's being explored in this book. This whole idea of a covenant of self-giving love is really a farce. The reality is, everybody's looking out for number one, and therefore, suffering is meaningless. Okay? That's the thought that's being explored in this book. And by the way, this is not just an ancient idea. If you have read Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, it's a contemporary expression of the idea that the fundamental life force in the universe is nothing more than the survival of the fittest, just the passing on of our genes. We're just particles and process, and that's it. And God says in this book, no, the view stated by the Satan in this book is cynical and warped and misguided and wrong. At the core of reality, at the core of the universe, is self-giving, self-sacrificial love, and therefore hope in a loving God is infinitely bigger than the pain of suffering. If that's what's at stake in this book, and we're going to get to your life. Now, Job gets hit with this second wave of suffering, and his body is covered with painful sores from the crown of his head to the soles of his feet. He sits on an ash heap, scrapes them with pottery shards. And he responds again, but this time there are some subtle differences in his response than after the first wave of suffering. He does not fall to the ground in worship. He does not say, "The name of the Lord be praised." He goes to an ash heap. He's sitting at the town dump. Maybe that's an act of grieving. Maybe he's quarantined like a leper. And his wife says to him, "Curse God and die." Okay, this probably did not cheer Job up. So let me say a word about Mrs. Job, because she gets dumped on a lot. Back in the 4th century, a great preacher, John Chrysostom, says that Job's greatest suffering is that God didn't take away Mrs. Job. But I want to say a word on behalf of Mrs. Job for a minute. She, too, has lost all that she had. She, too, lost all her children. She will now have to give care to a horribly diseased husband until he dies, and then she will be left alone and destitute. So she gives voice to thoughts that surely have occurred to Job, that occur to all of us when life gets deeply not okay. Now, he doesn't do it. He doesn't take her advice. But notice what he says to her. He says, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" Job is struggling to understand God now. Is God the kind of person who sends trouble? Is God really good? We're told at this point, after the second wave of suffering, in all this, Job did not sin in what he said. Remember, after the first wave, in chapter 1, verse 22, the text simply says, "In all this, Job did not sin." Now there's a little qualification. Job did not sin in what he said. In his heart, Job has begun to struggle. Then Job's friends hear about all his troubles, and they go out to comfort him. Here's what we're told in the second chapter. When they saw Job from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud. They tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. They'd heard it was bad about Job. Nothing prepared them for this. Usually, when you visit somebody in bad condition, you try to cheer them up. You'll tell them, "That's not so bad. You don't look so bad. You look pretty good." Ever have been sick and have somebody come to visit you, take one look at you, and burst into tears and rip their garments? That's not going to cheer you up. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great was his suffering. I want to pause here for a moment. Imagine sitting with someone in silence for 7 days and 7 nights. This was such a powerful act that it actually became a part of Jewish life. And to this day in Judaism, folks will speak of sitting Shiva, literally sitting sevens. Friends will come and sit with one who mourns over a period of a week. This is maybe the greatest example in the Bible of what Paul commands us in the book of Romans when he says, "Mourn with those who mourn." And it's so striking to me. He doesn't say, "Fix people who mourn." He doesn't say, "Give advice to people who mourn." He doesn't say, "Tell people who mourn they shouldn't mourn. They ought to be hopeful because everything's going to turn out okay." He doesn't say, "Tell them, if you just have enough faith, if you just pray hard enough, if you just believe enough," the kind of stupid things that we will sometimes say to other people. This is real important for us to be a community where it's okay to not be okay. Paul just says, "Mourn with them," and that's what they do. It's interesting. After the 7 days are done, they will speak a lot, and they will get in trouble for it. They're kind of like Dorothy's friends in that old Judy Garland movie, "If They Only Had a Brain, If They Only Had a Heart." But their silence was brilliant. And you know, a big reason why we have life groups where we talk about going in, have an authentic community, when it's not okay, you need people to come sit with you and bring you food and be still with you. You can do that for somebody who's suffering. You don't have to fix them. Just be with them. Finally, after 7 days, Job speaks. And as we read this book now, we're waiting eagerly to hear what Job will say. And if he can just repeat what he said in chapter 1, "God gives, God takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord," the test will be over and Job will be a real short, happy little book. Job chapter 3, After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Now, this is why Job did not have a big TV ministry. Okay, this is not Tony Robbins positive thinking kind of stuff. And for the next 28 chapters, Job pours out a level of bitterness and confusion and sorrow and doubt and anger towards God that is staggering. Listen to what he says. The arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks in their poison. God's terrors are marshaled against me. Hey, God, you're shooting at me. Job says, God has wronged me and drawn his net around me. So ironic to me, sometimes people will speak about the patience of Job. Not in this book. Makes me wonder if they've ever read it. Job's words, you read through the book, are incredibly impatient. How long? Why me? Speak up. Make it stop. Where are you? What's going on? Sometimes in suffering, we're told, just trust in God. Not in this book. Job accuses God. Job blames God. Job challenges God. Job attacks God. Job confronts God. Not as a skeptic, not as an atheist, as a believer. And he does this in such an honest, raw, vitriolic, unvarnished way that his three pious, God-believing friends can't stand it anymore. Job, what are you saying? And they argue with him. They present an alternative point of view to what Jesus, to what Job is saying. Now, their point of view is from what is called Mesopotamian wisdom literature. That's kind of ancient self-help books. If you went into an ancient bookstore in the Mesopotamian world 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, and you went to the self-help section, that's what you would see. And the core idea in this literature is, if you're suffering, you must have done bad. If you're prospering, you must have done good. So if you find yourself suffering, just identify what you've been doing wrong and stop doing it, and then your life will be good. Now, if you've ever read Job, you've noticed the middle 30 chapters of the book or so get incredibly repetitive and boring. And it's okay to say that, even though it's in the Bible. That's actually on purpose. See, the writer hits us over the head with this. Job does not claim to be perfect. The idea that we earn our blessing and our suffering is not true. That's what Job is saying. And I'm living proof of that. You know, the idea that if it's blessed, it's because I'm good, and I'm suffering, it's because I've been bad. That's not true. Job says, if only I knew where to find him, if only I could go to his dwelling, I would state my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. But of course, nobody can see the great and powerful God. Not nobody. Not how. It's funny how often in suffering we're told, just trust God. But Job doesn't do that. He challenges God. Or maybe to challenge God is to trust him. I wish I could take God to court. If only God would show up, we could fight it out man to man. Now in chapter 38, Job gets his wish. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. Question, what do you think that moment was like? Just imagine being Job right then, and God shows up. Who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Prepare to defend yourself. I will question you. You answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched the measuring line across it where footings set, or laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Now you notice, if you read through the book, when God does appear, he doesn't seem to get around to answering Job's question of why. This is very important. It's very deliberate. God does not tell Job what the writer has told us about the upper stage scenes of chapters 1 and 2. He doesn't tell him about that whole conversation with the Satan, the accuser. He just asks Job a bunch of questions that Job can't answer. Why does God do this? For a long time when I read this book, it looks kind of mean on God's part, like he's kind of picking on a guy who, of course, is way dumber than God is. We're all dumber than God is. Now, part of what's happening is God is pointing out Job has a finite mind and a limited point of view, and should not expect to be able to understand everything, and that's true for all of us. But something way more is going on that's very important. There's an Old Testament scholar named Ellen Davis that points out God's questions are leading somewhere. They're indicating something about the kind of person God is. Look at this. God says, who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain, a path for the thunderstorm, to water a land where nobody lives, an uninhabited desert, to satisfy a desolate wasteland, to make the wasteland sprout with grass? Now, in the ancient world, in Israel, this would be real striking. Life depended on rainfall. They would never waste water. Yeah, a little bit like the drought that we're in. So why would God water a land where no one lives? Because God is a God of gratuitous goodness. He is good for no reason at all. He is good because he just loves to give, because it's just the nature of God's foolishly loving heart. He delights in animals that are of no apparent use at all. They're not strategic at all. Book talks about God makes the ostrich. She flaps her wings joyfully, although she'll never fly. Her wings are utterly useless. She leaves her eggs in the ground, doesn't even remember where they were. She's a lousy parent. She's the opposite. Remember, Job was so cautious as a parent, just being really careful in case his kids might have sinned. She didn't even remember where she left her kids. She will never be mother of the year. Yet when she spreads her feathers to run, she laughs at horse and rider. God says, I made the ostrich because I have a need for speed. I love her. Silly, useless animal. God says in chapter 40, I made the behemoth, probably the hippo, useless to you. In the ancient world, that was considered a chaos monster that had to be destroyed. But not to God. God says he ranks first among the works of God. Best thing I ever did, God says. I had my A game going the day I made that behemoth. God delights in the wild ox that will never plow, never serve farmers. He delights in the wild donkey that will never be tamed. He delights in mountain goats that give birth in secret places that no human being will ever see. In the Leviathan, most likely the crocodile, that nobody will ever be able to eat or use for food. God says nothing on earth is his equal. This whole section is God creating and caring for and giving to and delighting in animals that aren't good for any purpose anybody can imagine. Why would God make a world like that? And the author, Annie Dillard, has this great statement. She says, it's because the Creator loves pizzazz. So he revels in the beauty and goodness of the least strategic of his creatures. Beauty, and not just beauty. There's an old distinction between beauty and the sublime. Beauty is goodness that we can see and enjoy and understand. The sublime is transcendent. It evokes mystery and wonder and awe and worship because it points to another world where everything is the way that it is supposed to be. Beauty is the rainbow. The sublime is somewhere over the rainbow, way up high. There's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. There is a God over it all, somewhere over the rainbow. And that God is gratuitously good and uncontrollably generous and irrationally loving. And he just gives for no reason at all. It's his nature. He can't help himself. God loves pizzazz. Job never does find out about the conversation in heaven for a very important reason. It's not because that got left out. He never finds out about it because his story is your story. Because in this life, on this not okay earth, you live, I live, down here on the lower stage. And we don't get to know, we don't get to see, we don't get to hear. But Job finds out about something way better. He finds out who God is, irrationally loving and gratuitously good, and unbelievably self-giving. That's enough. And he says to this God, my ears had heard about you, but now my eyes have seen you. And that's enough. The goodness of God and the reality of his presence, that's enough. Now, the book of Job ends with a little epilogue. It's very significant. It looked odd to me for a lot of years at first. God says to Job's comforters, this is in verse 7, I am angry with you because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Now, you have to imagine the amazement, the spiritual confusion and disorientation of Job's friends. When Job complains about God, yells at God, accuses God of shooting him with arrows and not being faithful, they stick up for God. They defend God, so they know they're right. And then God shows up and says, nope, Job was right and you were wrong. And God says, but if Job will pray for you, I'll forgive you. I imagine Job and his friends had some very interesting conversations at this point. Hey, Job. And Job prays, and God forgives them. God forgives his defenders when they are prayed for by God's relentless attacker. What a weird book. And then we're told the Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the former part. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 donkeys. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. The first daughter he named Jemima, the second Keziah, and the third Karen Huppuck. Nowhere in all the land were there found women as beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father granted them an inheritance along with their brothers. Now, that seems kind of strange. There's something going on here that we would tend to miss, but that would jump immediately out for ancient readers in that day. The writer does not tell us the names of Job's 7 sons, but he gives us the names of Job's daughters. In Hebrew genealogies, that was unheard of. That was unprecedented. That screams out for an explanation. And not just that, he gives us the girls' names, and they're strange names. Generally, Hebrew names are very serious. They express character, they express virtue, or they're used to express some real important kind of theological truth or what it is that God's up to. These three names are all about beauty. They're almost silly names. Jemima meant dove. That was the picture of a bird that was considered exceptionally lovely. Ketziah is a Hebrew word for synonym, for prize spike. Does anybody here like Cinnabons? You walk into a mall, Cinnabon is one of the greatest proofs of the existence of God I know. Karen Huppuck means horn of shadow. Job named that girl after makeup. It'd be like naming your daughter Revlon or Maybelline or something. Not only that, he gives them each an inheritance. Now see, in the ancient world, what you gave to your sons would take care of you in your old age. It was like a 401k. A father with 7 sons would never give an inheritance, his stuff, to his daughters, because that stuff would go to the in-law side of the family. Sons were financially strategic. Daughters were not. You'd just be blowing that money. Why does the writer include this? What's Job doing? He includes it because now Job delights in and gives to the least strategic creatures. Job has become gratuitously good and uncontrollably generous and irrationally loving, and he gives for no reason at all when he cannot possibly profit or gain by it. He has become the wonderful Wizard of Oz. Does that remind you of anybody? Somebody would come centuries later, and he would sound, when he would talk about God, an awful lot like God sounds in Job. He'd say things like, consider the lilies of the field. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you that Solomon, in all his glory, all of his work, all of his wealth, was not dressed like one of these little flowers of the field that nobody sees, that's here today and gone tomorrow. Why should the lilies of the field be so beautiful? Because there's a father that loves them. And we live in his world. And he does it surely out of his goodness. And this man, this son of Job, would live east of Eden in a not okay world, in the land of Uz. And he would suffer, although he was without sin. And when he died, we're told that the curtain that hid the holy place of the presence of God in the temple was torn in two. It's like on the cross we could see the love of God, even though God didn't look at all like what we expected such a great and powerful force to look like, even though Satan would say, pay no attention to the little man behind the curtain. See, Satan was dead wrong about old Job. The central question in Job is, could a human being hold on to God and faith and love and goodness when it does not seem to pay off at all? One could, and one did. Job could not see the upper stage. Job did not know that his faithfulness had meaning beyond his wildest dreams. He did not know that something cosmic and eternal and vast and magnificent was at stake in his little life. Sitting on an ash heap, scraping boils off his skin with shards of broken, discarded pots, broke, sick, mocked, confused, hopeless, Job's faithfulness in suffering was being used by God to vindicate God's whole wild adventure and covenant love. His honesty and perseverance have been used now for thousands of years to inspire billions of people who live in the land of Oz. Hang on, keep going, don't let go, don't give up. You have no idea. God is so close. God is so good. And the writer wants to say that not just to Job. He wants to say it to us. He wants us to say it to each other. He wants us to hear it for ourselves. We live in the land of Oz. We live, and this is what we'll be talking about in this series, in the land of anxiety and fear and failure, and divorce and relational breakdown and confusion and hurt. We all do. Why? I don't know. How long will it last? I don't know. Does your response matter? More than you can possibly dream. I'll see you next week.